Ever tried reading while jogging, cooking, or even juggling flaming torches? Yeah, it doesn't end well. But with audiobooks.com, you can conquer books without the circus act. Dive into over 450,000 titles, including more than 10,000 free ones. Get hooked on a bestseller, find your next obsession, or finally read that classic you've been avoiding since high school. And here's the inside scoop. Sign up today for a free 30-day trial and snag your first three audiobooks on the house. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.
Welcome back to Feminist Book Club, the podcast. We're not just about feminist books. We are here for social justice, literature, and media in all its forms. But we do that through an intersectional feminist lens. Thanks for being here. Let's get started.
Hello, everyone. It's Sally. Welcome back. We love you. I am so excited because today I'm here with a friend of mine, y'all, Annalicus Miller, who is the author of an amazing book that I'm obsessed with and I have now read twice. Love Across Borders, Passports, Papers, and Romance in a Divided World. Anna is a writer and journalist. She covers refugee and immigration issues. And this book is also a collection of refugee and immigrant love stories. I absolutely adored it, as I said. I'm so excited to have her on. Welcome, Anna.
Gosh, thank you for having me.
Oh, I'm thrilled that you're here.
I think you might be the first person that I know of that's read it twice. This is amazing, given that it's not even out yet.
I really enjoyed it. Second time as well.
Great. Love that.
To start off, what does it mean to you to be a feminist?
It's changed for me a lot over the years. I think it used to be sort of fighting for my place as a woman and sort of, you know, was very informed by, you know, both living in a patriarchal world and also working in an industry sometimes that's patriarchal. I'm a journalist. I also used to be a conflict reporter. So this was very, very male dominant, especially when you're in the field and it's very sort of macho. Everyone is, you know, sort of emphasizing how tough they are and stuff. And I felt like feminism at that point was really about sort of needing to be really tough in that type of a context to sort of like prove that I was one of the boys, which now that I say that, it sounds so absolutely stupid. But that was me at, you know, 26. And then, you know, as sort of I got a little bit older and, you know, my story that I detail in the book sort of continued, it became more about, you know, acknowledging both my own emotions and just the emotions of the world around me, and that every story is this incredibly emotional story and that everyone is coming from a different perspective, and just being much more open-hearted and seeing that as a power of being a woman as opposed to needing to be super macho and prove that, like, I could be part of this patriarchal society. So now it's very much seeing the power in being in touch with our instinct, being in touch with the emotions of ourselves and the other people around us and the stories that make up our world today.
The thing that really stuck out to me about that too was when you said open-hearted, because I think that that really comes through in this book. I'm a little bit of a cynic. The listeners will know me as like a lover of romance. But the reason that I love romance is because I am so cynical and I just need the promise of a happy ending. I just want to know from the beginning, you know, because in real life, I'm like, these people aren't going to end up together. But these people in your book, they end up together. I mean, at least for now, you know, life continues. But my cold little heart was just kept being melted over and over again with these people, and I was really rooting for them. I don't know if you have favorite couples or if it's like picking favorite children, but I have a favorite couple, especially upon my second reading. Mal and Muhammad really just, you know, that friends to lovers, slow burn, really captured my heart. So, you know, for all the romance readers out there, full of romance stories, and they are beautiful. Do you have a favorite couple?
I don't think I can pick because these are all people that like I actually know. I will say that with Amal and Muhammad, when he told me, he was like, that's when I realized I loved this girl enough to go to a war zone for her. I was like, I related to it so much. And I was also just like crying a little bit and kind of trying to keep it together. A lot of the time doing these interviews, I was just really trying to keep it together myself. I was definitely like crying when I was talking to Oscar and Darwin, for example. And actually, Oscar just sent me really adorable videos the other day, and like, I cried all over again. They really do give you this idea that, you know, not only that love exists and that they do end up together, but also that the way that they end up together is by being so devoted to each other and by choosing each other every day. And this really, this idea that love is not necessarily a noun or an idea, but, you know, an active verb of sort of making decisions around these people. And that level of devotion was just something that I admired so much in people.
Yeah, it's stunning. And I really dove right in without telling anyone what this book was about. So what you do here is that you tell the story of passports, like the history of passports, border control, all of that. Like in a very like straightforward way, a very approachable way, of super like easy to read and accessible book. And throughout that, you tell the stories of people, real life people, and their love stories, how they were torn, impacted by the nonsense that are our modern borders. And the anchor of that all is your own love story.
Oh my gosh, it was so hard to combine all of these things. I think if I were to do it again, I would be like, no way, simplify your life. Like, do not try to bring basically three different concepts together. But in my like pandemic fever mind, I was like, this totally works. I'm delighted that it came out the way it did, but it was really hard to bring it all together. I think the big kind of inspiration for that came through my own story, where I was a journalist in Istanbul, and that's where I met my current partner, Salim, who's from Syria. For me, as a U.S. passport holder, I can travel so freely, which has been amazing for my career as a journalist, because I've gotten to live and work in all of these interesting places. And Salim is also a journalist, but he was much more limited just because he was Syrian and because of circumstances, because his country's at war. Is also a refugee. And I had this question because also my family is Arab American. And so I had this question too, where I was like, well, my family came from the Middle East kind of once upon a time. Why am I able to be this Arab American girl with a good passport when all Salim and all my friends from the Middle East are facing all of these travel difficulties? So that kind of inspired the research of what is the history of passports? What is the history of borders? Like, why is it that, you know, someone is criminalized when they're undocumented? Why is it that we live in this world where we have tons and tons of international flights connecting every single location you can dream of in the world every day? And yet you still have people who are paying smugglers to board these insanely dangerous rafts, people who are paying coyotes to be smuggled across the desert. When I was covering these stories as a journalist too, that was often missing. Like people, you know, ordinary people that are consuming the news would kind of be like, oh, who are these Syrians that are like boarding these boats? And like, why would you ever do that? And that why was really unanswered. So I was really sort of driven to be breaking that down in a way that was quite digestible and, you know, place the blame on the history and place the blame on these forces of really structural racism and white supremacy that are shaping the entire world. So I was at a point where I was like, okay, you know, maybe this chapter won't be about structural racism and white supremacy. And then it's like, and it is all over again. I'm just like, I feel like I'm beating a dead horse at this point. But that's what it was. And I wanted to place the blame and I wanted to say, what would our world look like without it?
Yeah, I mean, that is what it all comes down to. That's not, you know, that's not your fault.
You're just pointing it out. You're just a journalist.
You're just out here reporting the facts.
Out here trying my best to see the world in a positive light.
Yeah, for sure. Was there something that you learned while researching this book that really shocked or surprised you?
Oh my God. Literally everything. I have to give it to Cecilia, who is another one of the completely beautiful people in the book. She is really the one that turned me on to so much of the history of the U.S.-Mexico border and of the fact that, you know, this idea of we didn't cross the border crossed us, the fact that there's so many people that are indigenous to those areas of the country that used to be Mexico that are now the United States that I grew up in. I grew up in California. And I think it's really messed up that I didn't know that history and that a lot of people don't know that history, because I think it goes to show how this is really kept from us in schools. And it kind of goes back to this whole crackdown that's going on in the US right now on critical race theory and, you know, banning books and all of, you know, this kind of stuff from the far right. It sounds kind of weird to say, because as a journalist that wrote a book, I should be like, oh, I did all this like original research and like dug into archives. I really didn't. Like, a lot of these facts are hiding in plain sight, and yet we don't learn them in mainstream American schools. And, you know, I consider myself that I had a great education and stuff. So, you know, I really wanted to bring that to the fore. And that was a huge thing from my own country and my own context. Another thing was just this idea of statelessness that you really saw with Karina's story. Being Lebanese American and working in the Middle East, I was very familiar with the Palestinian issue. And I, you know, Palestine was the first place I lived and reported as a journalist. So I knew, you know, that the Nakba had made people stateless in this way. But when I met Karina and she told me that she was born in the former USSR and then, you know, asked for asylum in the US, it didn't work out. And then now she's stateless because the country on her passport doesn't exist anymore. You know, this blew my mind. And I'm someone that is reading about immigration issues every day. So, you know, that's another issue that I'm really hoping that this book can turn more people onto, because at the end of the day, it's, you know, not just an immigration issue, but a human rights issue.
Yeah, that stood out to me because I was born in the Dominican Republic. I became a U.S. citizen. When you become a naturalized U.S. citizen, you have to, you know, rescind all rights to whatever land you're leaving. I remember when I first became a U.S. citizen, which happened through circumstance, I remember I was obsessed all throughout college that, like, if my, like, if the U.S. just takes back my citizenship, like, I will be stateless. Like, I have nowhere to go and you're done. You can't go back there. And I just remember, like, my obsession with that, I think, was just magnified by the fact that anytime that I would tell that to somebody, they would be like, well, that's not how it works. Like, surely that's not true. Like, of course you can go back. And I'm like, no. I literally cannot. Like, it's no longer a functioning passport. So I am glad that this is something that is becoming, I guess, more spoken about. Or I don't know, is it? Maybe people are just talking to me about it more.
You know, Karina started the group United Stateless, which is doing really amazing advocacy work. I think they really struggle with the immigration in the U.S. just in and of itself is such this sort of political pawns, like, you know, the right does a little bit, the left does a little bit, even at its best, even sort of the most high profile issues that you have going on. That's something that does take so much explaining in terms of, like, okay, like, now we're not talking about people that are just undocumented. We're talking about people that actually don't have a place to go back to if they're deported. I still think that's incredibly marginalized in a conversation that is already very on the margins and not a priority in the general, you know, political echo chamber.
Yeah, I keep hearing ads for whatever that Lance Bass podcast is that he did with, like, the astronaut from the USSR who, like, was in space when, and so then he was stateless and in space.
Wow.
The US passport is losing its currency around the world. Like, people don't want, if they have an option of something else, they don't want a U.S. passport, which I guess it kind of connects to just, like, in your own story. Now Solomon is not using you for your papers. You're using him for his.
Right.
Tell us more about just, like, you know, they'll read about it in the book, but I think people would be shocked to even know that.
Yeah. I mean, spoiler alert, after everything, I ended up marrying a Syrian refugee for papers. I have universal health care now because I fell in love with a refugee. Highly recommend without giving too much away. Part of the reason why I ended up marrying Salem for his papers is because when our sort of chaos was going on, the Muslim ban was in full effect. So even if I had been at this stage of, like, oh, I'm, you know, let me just marry you so that you can come to the US. Like, first of all, I didn't know if I wanted to marry him at that point. Like, he was just my boyfriend. I was not ready to be the fiance part of a fiance visa. I just wanted the freedom to be a girl falling in love Like, no, when you get separated by borders, you do not get that freedom. That forces you to fucking shit or get off the pot. So, you know, I always say I feel like I aged about 10 years and like 48 hours when that happened. I went from being this like whimsical war correspondent commitmophobe to being like, put a fucking ring on it. Like, so, you know, that's my love story. And what was crazy is Salim basically got kicked out of Turkey where we lived. And then the Muslim ban was going on. So it was this question of where do we go? Because even though, I mean, I think some couples were able to get through who were affected by the Muslim ban, it was not a lot. And it took ages and ages and ages. And so we needed another option. And thank God he was able to apply for asylum in the UK. It's something that not everyone, of course, is able to do. But this has been our home now for the past almost 6 years, which is wild. And now we are starting to think about going to the US. But a lot of people ask me, they're like, you know, why? Why do you want to go back to the US? It's like, it really comes back to just being my culture, that I'm American, that there are things that I love about the country. If I had some kind of European passport, I know a lot of people that don't feel that way about the US who do kind of have those travel privileges, those not just travel privileges, but also kind of access to a really nice social welfare system that we don't have in the United States. So I will say that the US passport is losing some currency. I think, though, in the grand scheme of things, when you look on a global level, it is still incredibly powerful. And it's like, I always say it's just a privilege that I have by a pure accident of birth that, you know, I never had to think about getting citizenship or something like that. And it's really wild to me that it's something that some people don't have to even think about, that some people don't even know how difficult this is for some people. And then, you know, some people, my husband included, really devote their lives to just having something that, you know, resembles those same rights. So it is something that is a huge force of global inequality when you think about it like that.
Yeah, for sure. This book is so important. It's so timely. It's super easy to read. It's just fun and very heartwarming. I teared up multiple times. My little cold heart was melting. Is there anything else that you want to share with us about the book, about, I don't know, what's transpired since then? There's like so much happening in the world.
Oh my gosh, there is so much happening in the world. I just hope that you read all these stories and really take them to heart. And there's so much information that I wasn't able to include. So I'd really encourage people to, you know, look at some of the sources in the back if you're curious and you want to read more about a certain sort of culture or context. I hope that it inspires you in both, you know, the pursuit of social justice and the pursuit of love. So I'm on social media. My handle in most places is my name, Annalika Spiller. Salim and I are starting a YouTube channel where we're kind of exploring some of the concepts in the book and trying to go above and beyond, because there's so many things that I wasn't able to include. And he's a very excellent filmmaker. So we're a bit of a multimedia team in that way. Yeah, and I also have a newsletter called Love and Borders, which is annalikasmiller.substack.com. Please say hi if you enjoyed the book. Keep it to yourself if you didn't. Just kidding. Close free speech. But yeah, thank you so much for listening.
Thanks for being here. Thanks, y'all, for listening. We'll be back soon.
If you're a fan of funny, smart, snarky women writers like Samantha Irby, Lindy West, Sloane Crossley, or Jenny Larson, listen up. From award-winning TV writer Laura Belgrave, Tough Titties is a hilarious collection of full-body cringe, watch-through-your-fingers life lessons her own husband calls loser Sex in the City. Laura's wildly relatable coming-of-age stories include hate following her sixth-grade bully on social media decades later, moving home post-college to measure her self-worth in hookups with Upper East Side bartenders, dating a sociopathic man baby, proving herself in the early 90s at New York's coolest magazine as the world's worst intern, falling for get-rich-quick schemes on the internet, and most of all, saying tough titties to the supposed twos in life. Driving a car, being on time, handing in your paperwork, learning to roast a chicken, and having kids. peppered with cutting insights on our confusing, self-helpy culture that calls hair removal self-care and tells us to give our 110%, but also to give zero fucks. Tough titties will leave you feeling better about, well, everything. Let's face it, we're all tired of shame spiraling after being told what to do when we know we're not gonna do any of it. Tough Titties comes out June 13th from Hachette Books. Order from your favorite local bookstore or shop online at bookshop.org.
Hi, my name is Ashley, a Feminist Book Club content contributor, and I am joined today with Jenny Jackson. She is a vice president and executive editor at Alfred A. Knopf. She lives in Brooklyn Heights with her family. And she joins us today to talk about Pineapple Street, her first novel. Jenny, thank you for joining us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
My first question for you is, what is your definition of feminism?
My definition of feminism is finding success on your own terms. Pineapple Street is about three women in the same Brooklyn Heights family and their different relationships with money. We have the oldest sister, Darlie, who was born with money. Then we have Sasha, a middle-class girl from Rhode Island who's married into money. And then we have Georgiana. And Georgiana is the millennial conscience of the family who wants to give all her money away. And the rest of the family is not happy with her about it.
And something that struck me when reading this book, as it is set in a certain place, was there a metaphor for building a life in a home that's already been lived in?
Yes, yes, yes. So one of the funny inspirations for Pineapple Street came from a close friend of mine who lives here in Brooklyn. And during the pandemic, her in-laws moved out of their brownstone in Brooklyn Heights. And they said, hey, you and your husband and your baby can move into our house. It's all yours. And that, I mean, it was just an unfathomable gift to be able to move in to an apartment, but they had never moved out. And so their closets were full of clothes. And, you know, she asked, well, can I put some coat hooks by the door? And her mother-in-law said, oh, no, you really don't want to put in coat hooks. And so it was this very physical thing, like, how can I find room for myself here when there physically is no room? And that becomes a metaphor for Sasha in this book, who has moved into this home, but the family doesn't want her there. They don't trust her. Due to a misunderstanding, the sister-in-laws have given her this pretty mean nickname. They call her the gold digger or the GD. And there's a lot of kind of baked in classism that she is facing as she tries to join this family.
Yes, I mean, between Sasha and Georgiana, there's this conversation of like, hey, can you pick up your things? And they are precious to Georgiana, but it's also like they've been here for generations practically, or at least since she was a child. Why can't they just stay where they belong in this house? And I don't look at these items, but can they just stay right where they belong in this sense of like nothing's changed?
Yeah, Georgiana does not want to be thrown out of her childhood. She doesn't want to be replaced. And Sasha comes to see a little bit of her own hypocrisy because she is so angry with the Stockton family, with her in-laws, for not welcoming her with open arms. But her own family has been a little too welcoming to one of her exes. And so she sort of has to figure out what is fair when it comes to making someone really part of the family.
Yes. There was something that I noticed in the story. There was wealth and consequences, and not necessarily like bad consequences, but just the choices that you make and the aftermath of it. One being particularly someone that Malcolm, Darlie's husband, works with. This young man gets into trouble, and then all of a sudden he has a new job.
Yeah. I mean, I think that that's a pretty extreme example in this book of wealth and consequences. A young man that Malcolm works with at an investment bank makes a really bad mistake. And because of his background, because of his family connections, he just lands another job easy as can be. But I think that what we all know is that when your family has money, you have a safety net that other people don't have. If you lose your job, then maybe your mom can float you money for your rent that month, you know, or even if she can't, maybe you can move back home and live with them. that there, we just walk through the world with our varying degrees of safety net, and that tells us what kind of risks we can take. And so privilege is just this big kind of get out of jail free card that people might not even recognize that they're walking around with in their pocket.
Right. And I like the way that privilege is spoken about in this book. It's not so much because they're wealthy, they get to do whatever they want, but there are things that they have to reckon with that comes from having wealth, whether it's their relationships, who they are to themselves, their desires. And I think it provides an interesting perspective on privilege and also speaks to wealth as the reader may not know it.
Thank you. We've seen our sort of the income inequality grow greater and greater in America. It's made us all take a much more serious look at what inheritance really means. You know, I mean, Warren Buffett once said, your life shouldn't be dictated by your membership in the Lucky Sperm Club. That for so long, we as Americans were pretty happy to kind of glorify the rich, or at least grudgingly admire the rich. But I think that we've seen, you know, starting with Occupy Wall Street and, you know, now Bernie, AOC, the popular culture is starting to reckon with privilege in a very different way.
Exactly. And much of this book, as it is about wealth, to me, it was more about the relationships, the siblings, themselves, between the parents and Sasha and Cord, who are in a marriage. What was essential for you to say about relationships in this story?
I think that each of their separate relationships has probably been somewhat hampered by a family attitude about what is appropriate and inappropriate to talk about. And I mean, I know that their WASPs are famously repressed. I actually come from two parents who are Southerners. My mom's from Tennessee and my dad's from Oklahoma. And I was raised with this attitude that you should just put on a happy face. There is no, you know, let's talk about something more positive. If you can't say something nice, don't say anything at all. And so really our family ethos was like, keep it upbeat, keep moving on, don't dwell on the negative. And I think that that kind of coaches you to avoid difficult conversation. This family, they're a little different. They're not Southern. They're New York WASPs, but they have this same attitude of avoiding difficult subjects and repressing and avoiding difficult conversations. And this comes to a head for each of them. I mean, specifically for Cord and Sasha in their marriage, they don't ever want to face the fact that their backgrounds are actually quite different. And the more that they've swept it under the rug, the more those cracks have begun to grow. And so each character kind of has to deal with the fact that they have pushed away some difficult conversations and they have moments of reckoning.
Exactly. And with that said, so you have Sasha and Malcolm who have married into the family. How was their perspectives a keen part of the story, particularly related to race and class?
Yeah. So Malcolm is second generation Korean American, and he and Darlie, his wife, have always had this incredible intellectual connection. They just both are obsessed with aviation, investment banking. And because Malcolm makes a lot of money, it had seemed to Darlie like their marriage was pretty even footing. And she just didn't feel like the fact that his parents were first generation Korean American mattered. But when Malcolm loses his job, the ground shifts under their feet and Darlie decides to keep that a secret. And the fact that she keeps his firing a secret, it makes her have to later on examine her motivations, and it makes Malcolm question her motivations. Does she not think he is worthy if he doesn't have money? How does that tie in to his upbringing? What does that mean? And Darlie does openly grapple with the fact that Asian men in the world of investment banking are not getting the same old boy treatment that, you know, her brother or father might. So that's a big part of the story for them. Sasha is white, comes from a very different class background, and does not bring money to the marriage. And that has made it pretty difficult for her to fit in with the women in the family. So, you know, they've both married people from different social circles. And there's this fascinating article that I recommend people try, just Google it online. The author is Abigail Disney. Obviously, she's an heir to the Disney fortune. She wrote this article called How I Was Raised to Protect My Dynastic Wealth. And she writes openly about how she's sort of always been encouraged subtly to protect her principle. And some of that means marrying somebody who also has money. And, you know, on the surface, that's life will just be easier. You'll understand each other. You know, it'll be smoother. But also, you won't be diluting the family fortune by, you know, by marrying somebody who doesn't have one of their own. And it is a wild, I admire her so much for writing about it. It's a wild concept.
I will link that in the show notes. And I also want to note that there's a scene in the book at a golf course. Reading that scene, I felt that. Yeah. So when you all read the book and you get to that scene, I hope you all feel it too, because it is so profound without saying so much. And just watching how the character observes the room, it's profound.
Thank you. It was a very intense scene to write because, again, I'm not going to do spoilers, but because it just shows the expectations that we bring to a situation and the presumptions that we make and how deeply disappointed a character can be by the reality.
And also what the idea of appreciation looks like to somebody else.
Yes.
And it can be quite self-serving.
Yes.
Yes. So there's also an air of ambition and purpose in the story. We had Darlie, who was working, had a prominent career before she became a mother. As she was becoming a mother, Sasha is working on building a business. We particularly see that with the women in the story. What does ambition and purpose play a role in the story, particularly for the women?
Yeah, I love this because the character, Darlie, was the hardest one for me to write. At first, I didn't totally get her. I knew she was a mother. I knew that motherhood was part of her story. But for some reason, she just wasn't full in my mind until I realized that she was an incredibly driven woman. And, you know, she has this passion for investment banking. She has worked in banking. She had an incredible career. She had two children in quick succession. And she couldn't manage to stay in that high pressure job while having two young children. And I mean, there's a scene in it where she's like, you know, carrying her breast milk in the office to the refrigerator and her colleagues are mooing at her. That's a real story taken from a friend of mine who worked in banking. And I think a lot of us as women like went through those really rocky couple years of trying to have, you know, a newborn and a job, and it's incredibly difficult. But for Darlie, she ends up leaving her job, and it costs her a lot in terms of her sense of self. She feels like her worth has really been tied up in her achievement. And without that metric of achievement, she doesn't really know who she is or what to do. And so work means different things for each of the women in these stories, but Darlie's is the most sort of transactional. Her relationship with work is so absolutely tied to success, and she feels unmoored without it.
We've touched a bit about privilege, but there is so much that was tied to how they move regarding their upbringing.
Yeah. I mean, I think that I wanted each of them to recognize it. That was the first step, because in this novel, when it opened, I don't think that any of the Stockton children have spent much time thinking about it. And if they have thought about their privilege, they've only thought about it in the ways in which it's made their lives awkward. They'll say the right things. They'll say, oh, yeah, yeah, yeah. Obviously, it would be much worse to be poor. But this friend borrowed $2,000. She said it was for her sick mother, but she blew it all on cocaine. I felt used, you know? And so their relationship with privilege is pretty unexamined at the beginning of the book. Georgiana has the greatest transformation, because Georgiana actually wants to change her entire life. Cord is, I'm not going to actually spoil too much, but I think the others, the others over the course of the novel do finally see themselves a little bit better. Whether or not they take like major action to change it, you'll have to find out.
As I mentioned in your introduction, you're an editor at NOS. What was working with your editor like, and what are your principles as an editor?
Oh, I love this. So, you know, I have always taken such pride in giving my authors really thorough, intense feedback. And I've had writers who are really not that into revising. And I confess that I always found that sort of like annoying. Like, come on, I'm giving you great advice. Like, why don't you want to just get in there and do all the work? And I sort of thought that it was either laziness or they just, you know, they felt like they were done and they wanted to move on. And it wasn't until I got to the other side of the desk that I realized, oh my gosh, revision is incredibly difficult. The notes can feel overwhelming. And also writing new scenes is incredibly hard. Getting yourself back to the emotional and mental place where you were when you were tapped into a certain voice or character is, it's like trying to find a ring that you dropped at the beach. You know, you're like out there with your metal detector. Like, I know I was sitting somewhere around here, you know? So I found that to be such an unexpected challenge. I worked with three editors, one American, one Canadian, and one English, and they all worked together. So the editorial letter they sent me was 15 pages long. It was staggering. And I, you know, I did a ton of revision structurally, but the rewriting was the hardest. And I just feel like I'm going to have so much more empathy for my writers, but I also think I understand structure better. And I hope that, I just wish I'd done it a long time ago, because I think it would have made me a better editor all this time.
So you came at this beautiful portrait of Pineapple Street, which I Googled. And so these are real streets, pineapple, cranberry, and orange.
Yes.
I was taken out that these are real streets. And you painted this beautiful portrait with these characters in this particular section of Brooklyn Heights. Where's your favorite place to eat in Brooklyn Heights?
Okay, it's going to sound absurd because the name of this place is not good, but I promise you the food is incredible. It's called noodle pudding. I know, that doesn't even sound good, does it? You're like, gross. It is Italian. It's been in the neighborhood for a zillion years. It's cash only. You can't make a reservation. The menu is one of those huge books that they hand you and you're like paging through it. Like, oh my God, how long can I hold the tabby menu for? It is the most delicious thing. And also it's just, it's such a neighborhood spot that you go in there and you see like, oh, you know, Karen from the bus stop and, you know, Joe from like whatever. It's just, it's a super wonderful restaurant and neighborhood spot.
You sold me a cash only.
Oh,
I feel like almost every cash only place I've been to, it has to be good.
Right. You're like, how do you get away with being so inconvenient? Oh, you're amazing. Got it.
Right. Okay. And then my last question for you is, where would you like our audience to buy Pineapple Street from?
Oh, well, if you would like a signed copy, then go to Books Are Magic. And Books Are Magic has signed copies right now. You can get them either if you're in Brooklyn, come on into to Books Are Magic to the store, or you can get them on their website. Otherwise, I would love to see you shop at your local indies.
Excellent. Jenny Jackson, thank you for joining us to talk about Pineapple Street.
Thank you so much. What a wonderful conversation.
Thank you for tuning in to today's episode of Feminist Book Club, the podcast. Want to be part of the club? Here's how you can join us. Obviously, subscribe to our podcast and leave a rating and review for brownie points. Follow along on Instagram, Twitter, Facebook, Pinterest, and TikTok. All of those links are in the show notes. Sign up for our newsletter to be the first to know what our next monthly book pick is. And check out our award-winning monthly book subscription service. Oprah Magazine named it one of their favorite book boxes, and Shonda Rhimes called us one of her favorite subscription boxes in general. There are multiple membership levels for any budget, and it's an excellent way to support the show and the voices you heard today. See you in the club.
A well-read woman is a dangerous creature. Oh, 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 oh.
Whether you're looking to build a website for your business, your hobby, your podcast, or just for fun, Pear Networks is your go-to web hosting partner. Not only do we have the lowest domain price in the industry, starting at just $11, we've got hundreds of stunning website templates to help you stand out from the crowd. You're not a techie? Not a problem. With our easy DIY site builders, you can launch your impressive website without any technical know-how. And when it comes to security and updates, don't worry, we've got you covered. Our 24/7 US-based customer support is the best in the industry. Check out pair.com today to learn more. PAIR.com.
You love podcasts, the stories, the laughs, the unexpected turns. But when this episode ends, the silence starts. Not anymore. Audiobooks.com turns that silence into your next great adventure. With over 450,000 titles, from bestsellers to hidden gems, your love for listening just found its new best friend. And because you already know the joy of audio, we're giving you 3 free audiobooks to start your journey. Imagine your favorite podcast, now with unlimited episodes. That's audiobooks.com. Keep the story going. Sign up for your free trial at audiobooks.com/podcastfree today. Because for podcast lovers like you, the end of an episode is just the beginning. That's audiobooks.com/podcastfree.